The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Newt's World, Haiti began as a nation of liberation and resistance, but now finds itself on the brink of collapse under the weight of political chaos, economic devastation, and foreign intervention. Armed groups have overrun the nation. Government officials have fled following the assassination of President Moïse in 2021, and refugees embark on journeys by boat in search of safety in the United States and Latin America. In the aftermath of both natural and man-made disasters has left Haiti's infrastructure in ruins and its economy crippled. In his new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti, Jake Johnson delves into the heart of Haiti's tumultuous history and its current state of crisis. I'm really pleased to welcome my guest. Jake Johnson is a senior research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and has been the leading writer for the Center's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch website since February 2010, just weeks after a 7.0 earthquake devastated Haiti. Jake, welcome and thank you for joining me on Newt's World.
Appreciate you having me.
And before we get into the current situation, I'm really curious, why did you become attracted to studying Haiti?
Thanks. I think the important part is how we get involved, but also I think very relevant to everything that's going on now 15 years later. And so, you know, I was working in D.C. at the time of the earthquake in 2010, and I think like so many was, along with my colleagues, motivated to try and do something, to try and help in some way. And I think we realized pretty early on that a lot of the decisions about how money was going to get spent, who was going to get it, and what was going to happen in Haiti was going to have to do with decisions that were being made in Washington as much as decisions that were being made in Port-au-Prince. And so being in Washington, we had a unique role to play in that regard. And so for me, it was really starting to answer this question that everyone was asking after the earthquake, which is, $10 billion pledged from countries all around the world, where was the money going? And that was really my entrance into this topic and what has opened my eyes to a whole lot of things over the last 15 years.
Well, the earthquake in 2010 killed about 220,000 Haitians and displaced another 1.5 million. And the $8 billion in aid grants, the basic reconstruction costs were larger than the country's annual gross domestic product. Then you get drought in 2015 to 2017, leading to crop losses of 70%. In 2016, Hurricane Matthew decimated the country's housing, livestock, and infrastructure. Then there were back-to-back disasters. In August 2021, a magnitude 7.2 earthquake rocked the southern peninsula, destroying 30% of local homes, killing over 2,000 people, and displacing tens of thousands more. I mean, it's almost like Haiti has a target on its back and something happens negative on a regular basis.
Yeah, I totally understand that. And I think it's easy to say sort of, you know, Haiti can't catch a break, right? And these natural disasters are part of it. But, you know, natural disasters are also often accompanied by man-made disasters. The event itself, right? An earthquake, a hurricane, you can't stop that. But you can do something to limit its effect, to prevent it from having the damage and the deadly impact that it can have, and to recover from it and respond to it in more productive ways. And so, you know, I think that is true that Haiti has had a target at its back, but it's not just from nature. I think it's been from many very powerful countries across the world that in a lot of ways have had a target on Haiti's back for a long, long time.
Well, talk about that for a second, because you have, I think, a sort of romanticized vision of how the original Haitian rebellion occurred. It was extraordinarily brutal. The French were defeated and driven from the country. And at one point, the winning side had an explicit anti-white policy of just killing the colonists. So the country sort of started much more estranged from Europe and much more isolated in many ways than most of the other countries that were during that period also in rebellion. The long history of Haiti and the history of corruption in Haitian government, up through Papa Doc, for example, and Baby Doc, it seems to me there's a tragedy to the country that's very deep and very real and unbelievably painful for the people of Haiti.
There is a history of corruption. I don't think that is necessarily unique to Haiti. I think it's also important to talk about who has held political power in Haiti and if they're truly representative of the Haitian majority, right? But going back to its origin story, I mean, of course, the revolution was violent. I mean, the enslavement of the population for decades and centuries before was violent. But what I mean by the target on the back is that Haiti's independence was not met with open arms regardless. I mean, it took the United States 60 plus years to recognize Haiti's independence, to open up actual trade relations with the new Haitian state, with an independent Haiti. France did recognize Haiti in 1825, but only on a condition that Haiti pay an absurdly high loan or debt payment to France for its freedom, right? For the property that French merchants and landholders lost in Haiti. And so these things were important. You know, Haiti was seen as a threat to the dominant economic system of the time. And certainly it was forced to pay for that. And of course, today's situation is not solely about things that happened 200 years ago, right? I mean, we can talk a lot about more recent history and further actions from international actors. But I think, you know, one of the dynamics that's really consistent throughout Haiti's history is this nexus of a local political and economic elite and their relationship with external powers, and how that nexus of power and influence has really held sway over the Haitian state for 200 years, more than 200 years, and that it has never fully embraced the actual population itself or been a state that is representative of the full spectrum of the Haitian population.
From your perspective, you talk a lot about the very way in which we went about helping them in some ways hurt them.
That's right. And I think, again, this gets into more of some of the recent history. I mean, I think there's deep historical roots to all of this. But my engagement really started after the 2010 earthquake. And, you know, the mantra at the time was build back better, right? Learn from our mistakes of the past and do things differently this time. And that's not what we saw, right? And so I was tracking the money flows. Where was the money going? And, you know, the reality was a lot of the money was going to companies that were much closer to my office here in DC than they were to anybody in Haiti. And okay, I understand some of the motivations behind that, but the result of that was weakening local capacity, undermining local governments and local institutions. And if we really want to help build long-term sustainability, if we want to make sure that we're not being asked to contribute more aid in the future or spending more money, hey, we need to make sure that the money we do spend is actually building local capacity in a sustainable way.
Walk me through that a little bit. I mean, my sense is, you know, I think we first really intervene about 1922 or 1923. The Marines go into Haiti for a while. And then we've off and on had relationships where we've either tried to ignore Haiti or we've tried to help Haiti. We've certainly played a role in terms of who's president and how that has worked out. I remember Jimmy Carter and Sam Nunn and Colin Powell were sent down by President Clinton to meet with the Haitian president and try to sort things out. And I once had a chance to talk at length with Powell about it, and it was all surreal.
Yeah, you were Speaker of the House at the time, right?
Yeah. So I have a very real interest in this, and I'm totally puzzled by it. Then, of course, you have the recent assassination of the president, Moise. You have apparently a very dramatic increase in the size and power and sophistication of the gangs, which apparently occupy a very substantial part, dominate now a substantial part of the country. What fuels that? Is it drug fueled, or what is it about the gangs that enable them to become so strong?
Yeah, no, I think this is an important question, important dynamic. And I think to begin, they control a large part of the capital, right? And I think it is important to note that Haiti is much more than just Port-au-Prince, right? It's a country of 12 million. The majority of the population is outside of Port-au-Prince. And the majority of the country, while obviously affected by things happening in the capital, it remains largely peaceful, right? And so, you know, Haiti is not just violence and chaos right now. And we need to keep that in mind. But in terms of these armed groups, there's a long history of this sort of paramilitary action, non-state armed forces in Haiti, going back to Duvalier and even before. But I would trace this sort of recent phenomenon to a few things and a few different factors. One is there has always been a deep connection between these armed groups and the political and economic elite in the country. And that's because these groups are largely operating in communities, very densely populated communities that make up the majority of the population of Port-au-Prince. And those are also communities that surround the major ports and other businesses, right, that are of key importance to certain actors, and also are key electoral factors, because this is where the majority of the population are. And beyond that, whenever there are street protests or any, you know, demonstrations of that nature, they are often starting in these communities. And so control over these communities is extraordinarily important for the political and economic elite. And so while this has been a phenomenon that has deep roots, and some of these groups do have legitimate ties to their communities, they're not entirely divorced from that. But when we saw this big influx of money and new weapons coming into these groups really began in 2017, 2018, especially. And what was happening at that time were nationwide anti-corruption protests targeting the government and calling for accountability, an end to state impunity, and for real changes to the system of governance that was in place. And the traditional folks in Haiti who've held power and influence for a long time, many of them responded by directly working with, arming, funding, and organizing these armed groups in order to basically break that mobilization that was calling for change. And so we can see their rise, I think, directly linked to these political interests. And it's not to say that they are today entirely controlled by those same political or economic actors. I think there's a number of issues. Some of them certainly are involved in transnational criminal networks that involve drug trafficking. Arms trafficking has also exploded. So there are bigger factors and external factors, but also I think we can't divorce what's happening to these armed groups from the political reality.
Are there an identifiable number of discrete gangs that are coherent and organized?
The estimates say there's somewhere around 200 different armed groups in the capital and surrounding area. And traditionally, over the last number of years, they've largely been consolidated with some disparate actors under two broad coalitions that have largely been fighting one another over the last couple of years. And the big change that we've seen in the last few weeks is that they have all now apparently begun coordinating together and are working together instead of fighting one another, and have turned their guns on the state itself. And so that is obviously a significant change from what had happened before, and has led to what we've seen in terms of attacks on police stations, the national penitentiary, the prison, and state institutions themselves.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As I understand it, this sort of began to coalesce in October of 21 with a coalition of nine prominent gangs that became known as the G9. And its leader is a former police officer, Jimmy Charizier, who's known as Barbecue. I mean, this is almost like a movie. To what degree are the gangs beginning to create a coherent structure that could, in fact, directly compete with the state for control of the country?
It's a good question and an important one. I think there's a lot of things we don't know here. And the situation remains incredibly in flux. And so I'm going to be careful not to give too many predictions about the future because things are changing hour to hour on the ground. And putting together armed groups that 2 weeks ago were fighting each other and now are ostensibly, you know, fighting to overthrow the system and change the state, that is obviously a very fraught thing with internal difficulties and competition for power and different interests behind each actor. And so what their ultimate end goal is, I think, remains very unclear. I mentioned the political connections, and I think this is the reality that's even happening right now. And it's very clear to see. There's a sort of perception that these armed groups are seeking to take over the state themselves right now or exercising state control. Neither of those seems to be true, as far as I can tell. Their political support seems to be for this individual, Guy Philippe, who has been sort of putting forth his own government to take power in the midst of this transition process that is slowly forming, taking shape over the last couple of weeks. And so there seems to be a direct, at least coordination, if not outright direct organizational relationship between the armed groups and these political actors such as Guy Philippe, who are seeking to take power for themselves.
There's a countervailing group known as Wakali, which is a vigilante group that's out killing gang members.
The Wakali movement, a citizen justice movement. Look, this is a state that has failed the population for a long, long time. I was talking about that dynamic earlier. And when the state is not able to step in and protect a population and people are forced to choose between sitting back and being terrorized and facing death themselves or fighting back, I think we can understand that response. Whether you think it is right or just or legal or moral or anything, I think we do have to understand the desperation that causes this and the underlying context that leads to these sorts of outcomes. And look, we've seen it in recent days. I mean, the police force in Haiti has been politicized, decimated, and it should be noted, has received the majority of its funding from international actors for decades, but they have done nothing to actually strengthen the institution and have watched it be politicized by leaders in Haiti who are backed by the United States and are directly undermining these police forces. And so this creates a very challenging dynamic. And where we've seen success on the security front, it has largely been with police working directly with communities, because the only way a police force is going to be able to bring some order to the situation is if they have the trust of the population. And so when you see that coordination happening, that is what has actually been effective on the ground, certainly in the last couple of weeks, and really for the last many years.
Do we and our aid program help the police, or do we in fact undermine them with policies that don't work?
The great contradiction in U.S. aid policies more generally, right? I mean, often the aid itself is not what's causing the problem, but we try and silo everything out. So we think we can do these different things, whether it be health or education or security, but we don't understand or appreciate the longer effects and the way that our foreign policy and our political intervention directly undermines any effort we have, even if it could work. It's going to be undermined by a political situation that, again, the United States and other countries have a significant role in shaping. And so, yes, the U.S. and other donors have provided tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, probably billions of dollars to the PNASH, to the National Police as an institution over the last 20, 30 years. Is that been good or bad? Well, we can look at the police today and look at their capacity and say it's bad. But it's not just bad because of the nature of the aid. It's bad because all the rest of the policies and the political choices that we're making at the leadership also impact all of these other things.
Are we trapped into the leadership we back because it is, in fact, the structure of Haiti? I mean, would it be impossible for us to step in and try to create a healthy reform leadership with sort of coherent policies that tried to move the country to a better future?
I don't think the U.S. needs to be trapped. I think they're acting like they have. And I think we see this right now. The State Department backed de facto prime minister who was deeply unpopular for the last 30 months following the assassination of Moïse. And that was in the face of amazing organizing that was happening in Haiti, trying to put forth governance structures and roadmaps to restore democracy in the country. And those efforts were continually rejected and undermined. And we stayed with this guy, Henri, because he was there, because he was easy, because changing horses or going to some process that you don't know or don't control is an unknown. And for U.S. policymakers, I think the fear of the unknown is a real thing. You'll stick with the horse you got because you know them and you know that they're going to play with the game. And so that unknown is scary, but you know, the reality is sticking with the known has not produced any results. And in fact, I'd argue is basically blowing up in our face right now. And so, look, it's going to take trying something different. It's going to take choosing a different path. And that means not setting the agenda, not choosing what comes next, but providing space for Haitians to actually take the lead and to support what they come up with rather than controlling the process that comes up with what's next.
I mean, doesn't it sort of call for the Congress and the American people to sort of ask for a totally new approach? I was noting that one of the points you make, that the whole process of the United Nations between 2010 and 2020, allocating over $13 billion. I mean, this is not a very big country. And you would think at some point that $13 billion would have a positive impact. They may have had an ameliorative impact, and at least they minimized starvation, but it doesn't seem to me that they moved us towards a coherent, safe, and prosperous Haiti.
No, I think that's right. This goes to why it does take a rethink. It does take changing policies, because the reason why these things aren't long-term effective is certainly not only because of Haiti or Haitians. It's because of how we actually provide this support. Yes, the United Nations spent billions of dollars, but not all of that money was spent in Haiti by any stretch of the imagination. Same thing with the post-earthquake aid. You know, we hear these top line numbers, $10 billion, $8 billion, whatever it is. But that is not what actually makes it onto the ground. And it is very much not what actually makes it into the hands of any Haitians in Haiti. Right. And so, yeah, of course, it's not having the intended effect. If we want to do better, if we want to do something different, if we want to actually support a stable Haiti over the long term, it's going to take the U.S., the U.S. Congress, the U.S. administration, and the U.S. people sort of demanding those changes and changing their policies so that we're not just repeating these mistakes over and over and over again.
It's almost like there's a foreign aid industry.
Yeah, exactly. The aid industrial complex is what I refer to it in the book. And I think this is right. I mean, we look at Haiti and we say, oh, Haiti is corrupt, so we can't give money to the Haitian government or Haitian institutions. But the justification is often, well, we can hold U.S. companies accountable for what they do in other countries. The reality is we don't. We just don't. We gave hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to just a handful of contractors involved in the aid and development space in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then in Haiti. And audit after audit shows poor results, lax financial management, and all of these things, tons of problems. And yet we just keep doing it. We just keep doing it again and again and again. And it leads you to believe that for us in the United States, the goal of this is not actually the development we say it is, but something else. Because why else would you keep doing the same flawed thing over and over and over again?
So it's actually profitable for the foreign aid industry, even if it's not profitable for the people that supposedly we're doing it for.
I often say this, you know, in many ways, U.S. foreign assistance has become as much a jobs program here as it has in any place else, or certainly in Haiti. Look, you know how it is in Congress. It's hard to convince Congress to pass a foreign aid bill unless there's something for individual constituents and for the U.S. We ship food aid on U.S. ships, and it goes from excess crops from U.S. farmers. But that has a big impact on the ground in Haiti. We make it harder for Haiti to feed itself. And then we're act surprised when Haitians are looking to come to the U.S. But we have to look at some of these root causes that are causing this, and really simple changes that we could make that could go a long way towards reversing that dynamic.
One of your points, this is a problem of, as you put it, silos. As we provided food aid, we actually undermined local farmers.
Right, exactly.
We were taking away their market.
Free food aid in the aftermath of the earthquake. Like, yes, I mean, people do need food. I mean, that's important. But local farmers can't compete with free, right? And in the end, it's important that Haiti be able to feed itself and not just be reliant on aid continually. And that's important for all sorts of reasons. It's important for Haiti's sovereignty. It's important for the United States. This is in everyone's interest to see that outcome. And yet, these policies are doing the exact opposite. Right now, there's a tremendous humanitarian crisis in Haiti, more than a million, right on the edge of famine levels of hunger. And everyone wants to act. Again, everyone wants to do something. And I applaud them for wanting to do something. It's good that we want to do something, but we have to make sure that something isn't going to repeat this cycle that we've seen played out so many times in Haiti's history and in our history of involvement with Haiti.
As you point out in your book, you have such depths of corruption in the Haitian system that it seems to me it makes it almost impossible to really have an honest aid program inside the country. So the aid program essentially has to adapt to the realities of how things work.
Well, I think to an extent, yes, from a very just realist perspective, right? You put money into Haiti and a Haitian takes money off the top in corruption, it's only 80% that makes it to the ground. You give money to a foreign contractor, they take 20% off the top and pay salaries in Washington, and only 80% makes it to the ground. The actual impact is not what we're talking about here. And look, I think there are ways to hold actors accountable. I mean, so for the U.S., okay, is corruption an issue? You have oversight of the money. You demand transparency. And if there are instances of corruption, you would alert the appropriate authorities in Haiti, the justice system, the anti-corruption units, and urge them to investigate and bring a case. But instead, what we've done traditionally is give money, know exactly who's stealing it and who's being corrupt. And then we don't say anything because we're backing those people politically and we don't want to do anything to undermine their governance in Haiti. And so we're reinforcing this corruption throughout each of these interventions. And this was the dynamic certainly in Haiti after the earthquake, where it was a real political liability. You had Hillary Clinton, you had Bill Clinton taking outsized roles in the reconstruction effort. And so it was no secret that there was corruption in the Haitian government, but a scandal like that would have had domestic political implications here. And so there are reasons well beyond Haiti that we don't push for further accountability and end to impunity in Haiti. And the sad reality is it's often domestic political considerations that end up having a big role in shaping foreign policy decisions.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It struck me years ago that if you look at a map of that island, you can tell from overhead satellite pictures where the Dominican Republic is and where Haiti is. And it is so stark and so immediate that it's almost a stunning case study in the cultural impact of two different systems on the same island. In your judgment, is it possible to help migrate Haiti to a sustainable long-term pattern towards freedom and the rule of law and prosperity? Or is that such a big jump that Haiti, 30 years from now, will probably still be a basket case hoping people send money?
First, I think it's going to take a change in policy from countries like the United States, from the United Nations, from France, from Canada. We got to change ourselves, given the role that we continue to play in Haiti. And we're going to have to take a step back and let Haiti do it. I have supreme faith in Haiti's ability to do that, if given the opportunity. I want to go back to this dynamic. Michel Rolf Trouillot is a famous Haitian historian, and he has this concept of state first nation, that you have the Haitian state, and it has always been in opposition to the nation, the actual people of Haiti. And I think the sad reality is that foreign interventions and foreign policies, including our aid and trade policies, have really served to only reinforce that dynamic of a weak state that represents very narrow interests and not the interests of the majority of the population. And so long as that dynamic continues, the instability in Haiti will continue. Quite frankly, it's an unsustainable status quo. And I think for the role of international actors is, what role or what changes can we make to stop perpetuating that, to try and stop propping up that unsustainable status quo, but allow Haitians to change their system of governance and their relationship between state and nation?
So if the next administration came to you and said, give us a roadmap, you could come in and say, this is the new model, and we're doing this new model, and the rest of you have to figure out how you're going to adapt to this new model, because we're not going to try to figure out how to change you. So if somebody came to you and said, okay, we would like to have a program to enable the people of Haiti to have a dramatically better future, could you create a roadmap?
Well, I'll tell you who can create a roadmap. People in Haiti, they're doing it. They're putting that together. They're coming up with roadmaps. They're organizing around what they want to see happen in the future. And I think that's an important dynamic. You know, there is tremendous capacity in Haiti. Haitian people are more than capable of doing this, but they're trapped. They're trapped by a political and economic class that has not had their interest at heart and continues to be empowered by the actions of the international community. And so the simple thing to tell any administration is stop working with the people you've been working with. Stop listening to the people you've been listening to and open your ears and open your eyes to what's actually happening in Haiti. And so, you know, there are plenty of people who are coming up with these plans who are working hard to try and implement them. But there are barriers. And I think we can also view what's happening right now. I mean, the title of the book is Aid State, and it's a corrective to the notion of a failed state. It's a recognition that the state in Haiti is the product as much of external interference and external choices as the choices of the Haitian people. But its collapse, which, make no mistake, I don't like the term failed state, but the state is failing. The state has failed the population for a long, long time. It is collapsing right now. And that's an opportunity. That's an opportunity to reset the relationship between state and nation. It's an opportunity to reset and refound the state based on real principles of freedom and equality in Haiti. And that can happen, right? I am optimistic about Haiti's future today, just despite the dire situation that's taking place right now today.
How do you reach beyond the state to find the people to listen to who are capable of organizing? One, knowing that the traditional elites in the state that they have sheltered in will oppose you. And two, how do you then legitimize getting the ideas and the information from the people who, by your own definition, are outside the structure of power?
To begin with, it doesn't happen overnight, right? This is not something that any country or any person can snap their fingers and all of a sudden there's a perfectly legitimate government in Haiti that everyone respects and is doing something new, right? I mean, it's a process. I think that's the best I could say. And the process starts with having conversations with folks in Haiti, with folks outside of the capital. It means reaching out and actually opening doors to these folks in Haiti who have been systematically excluded from these conversations. If the U.S. wants to be playing a positive role, it can help open those doors. It can help provide that space, but it can't close the doors and determine who's in the room, right? And so there's going to have to be a negotiation. There's going to have to be a debate amongst Haitians, and it's going to have to involve people who are connected to the elite, people who are connected to the political world. But it's also going to have to include a lot of other people who haven't had that representation. And so, again, can international actors play a facilitating role in that process? I'd like to think so, but I'd also ask for a little proof before putting my total faith in it, because we've seen it go a very different direction in the past when international actors get involved. And so, again, it's possible, but it's going to take change on all sides of the equation.
Is there much to be gained, or is there much potential for encouraging and mobilizing the Haitian diaspora in the U.S. to be helpful back in Haiti, or is a difference in their two worlds so radical that is not really a practical thing?
I think it's an important conversation. And I think to begin with, I mean, they're already playing an important role because Haiti is one of the most remittance dependent countries on the planet. The diaspora is sending 20% of GDP to Haiti every single year. So the only way a huge part of the population of Haiti survives is through the support of the diaspora. But the diaspora is also not part of the political environment. They can't run for political office, things like this. And so there are ways to try and bridge these divides, to try and get the diaspora more involved, more engaged with the realities on the ground, and to build those connections. And I think there's a lot of efforts that are taking place. I think the diaspora can play other important roles. We've seen this with many other countries, is the role the diaspora can play in shifting U.S. policy, in becoming a political force here to demand the kinds of changes that we've been having today. Because it will take change and it'll take people pushing for that change. And so the diaspora can certainly play also a role here that will have a tremendous impact on the people of Haiti if they can organize and push for these kinds of changes that would make a material difference in how the world and how the U.S. interacts with Haiti.
That's really helpful. Jake, I want to thank you for joining me. Your new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti, is available now on Amazon and in bookstores everywhere. We'll have a link to it on our show page. And I really encourage everyone who's concerned about the crisis in Haiti to pick up a copy. I think you have very powerful and very important insights into the reality of what's going on there. I really appreciate your taking the time to educate me and hopefully help educate all of our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to my guest, Jake Johnston. You can get a link to buy his new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti, on our show page at NewsWorld.com. NewsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying NewsWorld, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of NewsWorld can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is NewsWorld.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money in markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.